planet Earth. Humanity's safe haven for over 200,000 years. But some now believe that time is coming to an end. Among them is the world's most famous scientist.
I am Stephen Hawking. I am convinced that humans need to leave Earth and make a new home on another planet. To stay risks annihilation.
In the last 70 years, the global population has tripled from 2.5 to 7.5 billion, and our space and resources here are limited. Professor Hawking believes we may have to find a backup plan.
We can, and must, use our curiosity and intelligence to look to the stars. We must start now. For humans to survive, I believe we must have the preparations in place within 100 years.
I'm Danielle George. I studied astrophysics and I'm now a professor of engineering.
And I'm Christoph Galfard. I'm a science writer and physicist. I spent over 6 years working alongside Stephen Hawking. We want to explore whether the human race can rise to Professor Hawking's challenge. Could we really ever find a planet and set up a new home for humanity? And if so, can we do it in such a short time?
To find out, we'll be traveling the globe, meeting the scientists already working on this epic challenge.
Whoa.
Discovering that behind closed doors, people are making amazing advances in space technology and answering the big questions.
Wow.
So do you think that planet is the best candidate we have if we want to colonize another world?
The answer would be yes at this moment in time.
How will we travel the vast distances? And what will it take to make a new planet our home?
Okay, Gene, so we arrive on a planet with no atmosphere. How are you going to keep me alive?
You might think this sounds like science fiction. But think again.
The search for a new Earth. Time-lapse film of a teeming city.
Professor Hawking has good reasons for believing that humans might soon have to leave the Earth. As well as overpopulation, there are countless other threats to the continued survival of our species on this planet.
It could be an asteroid hitting the Earth. It could be a new virus, climate change, nuclear war, artificial intelligence gone rogue. Earth's history is strewn with species and civilizations that have gone extinct.
Professor Hawking believes that if humanity is to avoid the same fate, scientists face a huge challenge. Is it really feasible to create a new human colony in just 100 years? The first question to ask is obvious. Is there another planet for us to go to? The place to find out is here, at Paranal Observatory, in the middle of Chile's Atacama Desert. I've been given a rare chance to see one of the world's most powerful telescopes in action. When I was a child, the only planets we knew about were the ones in our own solar system. But none of these are suitable for humans to live on. Now, though, we're discovering that those aren't the only planets out there.
The roof slides open.
Here at Paranal, astronomers search for new worlds outside our solar system, across the Milky Way.
This is European Southern Observatory's aptly named Very Large Telescope, the VLT. And I can't deny, it's pretty massive. And this is where some of the world's top planet hunters hang out.
As our own star dips down over the horizon, these incredible instruments come to life.
A sharp beam of yellow light pointing to the skies from one of the VLTs.
The VLT is in high demand with researchers from around the world. Tonight, Artur Vigen, and Raphael Galachet are the planet hunters. They're trying to determine if their current target star has a planet orbiting it.
She stands behind them as they work at their computers.
So now you can see there is a star here.
Oh, great.
What we will want to do is to subtract all this light, which is light from the star that we are not really interested in. What we are interested in is the light of a faint planet that would be around.
Planets orbiting other stars are known as exoplanets. So far, astronomers have discovered over 3,000. And tonight, Artu and Raphael may add to the tally.
No, I'm not sure. I'm not convinced.
So you think this is it?
I think it is.
Yeah, it's possible. It's possible.
Team here, optimist, pessimist, is it? I hope it's a planet.
We'd have to reobserve that star in a few months from now. And if it's still moving with the star, then it means it's a planet.
So if it turns out to be an exoplanet, do you guys get to name it?
Yeah,
with a B after the name of the star.
Excellent. And do we know what star it is?
Yeah, we know, but we cannot tell you.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, until it's confirmed and it's published, everything's a secret.
So is there a general consensus amongst planet hunters to how many potential exoplanets there could be?
We are really starting to think that planets are ubiquitous in the universe.
Really?
That they are really everywhere. I mean, we've discovered the first exoplanets about 25 years ago, and now we are finding more and more. Almost, on average, we find a few planets each day, a few new planets each day.
Each day, wow. Yeah. So I should probably get out your way then. That was a hint. Yeah, thanks, Raphael. Good luck, guys. See you later.
The researchers at Paranal think there could be billions of potential planets in the galaxy for a new colony. But our criteria have to be pretty demanding.
In slow motion, he's walking along parched desert ground.
Humans are very fragile creatures. We've evolved in Earth's very specific habitat. Stray too far from this, and we're in trouble.
Out here in the Atacama Desert, it can get pretty hostile. It is one of the driest, saltiest deserts on Earth. But compared to pretty much any other places we might land on one day, this is positively idyllic.
So, a potential new planet has to pass some stringent tests.
First, we need to find a planet that's rocky and about the same size and density as the Earth. It needs to be at the right temperature, not too hot, not too cold. Just right.
That's because for us to survive on a planet, we need water. And that water should be liquid and on its surface. Too far or too close to its star, and water will be ice or steam. Only in a narrow orbit will conditions be just right. What we call the Goldilocks zone. For our sun, a yellow dwarf star, the Goldilocks zone stretches from roughly the orbit of Venus to the orbit of Mars. Earth sits neatly right in the middle.
A graphic shows Earth's position from the Sun between two planets on either side of it.
But even if we find our perfect Goldilocks planet around another star, there is one more tough criterion. We have to be able to reach it. Most of the things we can see in the night sky are a very, very long way away. Space is so enormous that using miles to measure it doesn't really work. Each light year, a better way to measure it, is around 6 million million miles. Even the brightest stars in the sky are unbelievably distant.
Over here is the Orion constellation. And this is Betelgeuse, one of the biggest stars we know. It is nearly 500 light years away.
It might seem hopeless to explore those stars and their planets. But luckily,
not all the stars are quite so far away.
Now, over there is Proxima Centauri. After the Sun, that star is the closest to the Earth. Our stellar next-door neighbor lies just 4.2 light-years away. In cosmic terms, that is a tiny distance.
For human travel, it's still a long way, but seems much more realistic than most others. A planet around Proxima Centauri might just be reachable. But looking with the Very Large Telescope, we can't see one. Some planets are hidden from even the most powerful telescopes by the brightness of their stars. To look for a planet around Proxima Centauri, we'll need a different method.
Swing ball.
Indeed. May the best man win.
They start batting the tennis ball.
Oh, well, you've trained, obviously.
Yep, we had this when I was a kid in my backyard.
Astronomer James Jenkins uses a less traditional method to look for exoplanets.
So tell me, what does the swing ball got to do with finding planets?
Well, if we consider that the ball is a planet and the post there represents our star in the centre, we can see that the planet orbits the star. And not only that, the planet exerts a gravitational force, it pulls the star. And we can see with this analogy of the post that there's a wobble, a movement of the star. And that's what we search for when we look for planets.
All right.
James and his team used the telescopes in Chile to observe the Proxima Centauri star for 60 nights in a row. Each night, they measured the backwards and forwards movement of the star, looking for the telltale sign of a wobble. Back inside Paranal Observatory's astronomer's residence. And yes, that is the hotel from James Bond Quantum of Solace. James shows me what they found as the results came in.
Each night, as this data was coming in and we were putting those points on this plot, we started to see this kind of oscillation. And this wobble of the star that we can see here told us, hey, the indications we found before were correct.
That there is probably something out there.
There is probably a planet. Each night we were seeing this confirmation. And after 3 weeks, we knew pretty much for certain Proxima B exists.
So do you think that planet is pretty much the best candidate we have if we want to colonize another world?
I would have to say the answer would be yes at this moment in time. Just the distance between the Sun and Proxima Centauri, the fact that it's the nearest star to our Sun, and it has this planet that could be Earth-like. If in the future that we can build craft that can travel between the stars, I think that Proxima B would be basically the first stop on that journey.
That's the best thing I've heard for a long while.
I'm glad to hear that.
That's very good news.
Thanks to James and his team's remarkable discovery, we now know that amazingly there is a planet in our neighborhood that could be suitable for colonization. Welcome to Proxima B. From our observations, we know it's a little more massive than the Earth. And it's almost certainly a rocky planet. Its year, the time it takes to orbit its star, is just 11.2 days. That means Proxima B must be very close to its star. But because its star is a red dwarf, much smaller and cooler than our Sun, this planet does sit in the Goldilocks zone. And there might just be liquid water at the surface. This planet could be our best destination for humankind's new home. And it's our near neighbor. But Proxima B is still not that near. 4.2 light years is a staggering 25 million million miles, far beyond anything we've reached with a spacecraft before.
a computer-generated image of Proxima B in space, then archive footage of a Russian astronaut climbing the steps to his spacecraft.
Since humans first ventured into space, we've been using basically the same technology.
An American space rocket blasting off.
Space rockets burn chemical fuel. This produces gas, which pushes them through space. The hotter the gas, the faster the rocket travels. But gas can only get hot enough for the rockets to reach about 24,000 miles an hour. Pretty quick, but not quick enough for our trip. One of these rockets would take 120,000 years to get to Proxima B. To reach our new planet within Professor Hawking's timeframe, we're going to need a huge technological leap.
This is an enormous challenge. We have lost the momentum of the space race that was driven by the Cold War. We need to start again. It isn't impossible. To leave Earth will take a global approach. Everyone should join in. Our best minds need to focus and rekindle the romance and the exploratory spirit of space travel found in the early lunar expeditions.
Houston, Texas.
Incredibly, here in Texas, one of those great minds is already working on this challenge. Franklin Cheng Diaz is a rocket scientist and former astronaut.
Is that you?
That's me. First spacewalk, we were doing some construction job on the International Space Station.
Franklin has built a revolutionary rocket engine in his workshop that's powered not by traditional rocket propellant, but by plasma. Plasma is a state of matter formed when a gas is given so much energy that its atoms are transformed into a stream of charged particles. Lightning is one example. Because plasma can be so much hotter than the gas produced by a chemical rocket, it could push a spacecraft much faster.
Here it is.
There we go. Wow. Nice.
So this is the vacuum chamber, and the rocket is inside.
So you're creating the vacuum of space in there.
Absolutely, that's the point.
Using plasma in an engine like this could change the way we travel in space forever.
How does the engine actually work?
The way you make the plasma is you start out with gas, and it goes into a cavity. In that cavity, there is an antenna. And that antenna shines radio waves into the cavity.
Okay.
And the gas becomes a plasma.
Okay.
Which is about maybe 3 to 5 million degrees.
Now you're talking hot.
Now you're talking
yes.
hot. And then you just let it go. And that makes a heck of a rocket.
The magnetic field inside the chamber directs the charged plasma cloud and forces it into a nozzle shape to create a powerful jet.
Can we see it in action?
We can certainly do. We can certainly see it in action.
So that's the back of the rocket.
This is the business end. Okay. Okay, here it comes.
This superheated jet, thousands of times hotter than conventional rocket exhaust, is what provides the engine's thrust.
So with this kind of thrust, how fast can a rocket go?
You can go about 10 times faster than a conventional rocket, and that will get us to Mars in as low as 39 days. That's essentially the plan.
And why is this better than a conventional rocket, the ones we use today?
The simple answer is that it's more efficient and requires less fuel.
Working with NASA, Franklin is close to trying out his plasma rocket in space, where he predicts it could reach speeds of over 100,000 miles per hour. If it works, it could completely transform space travel.
We want to be able to put out this rocket in service in a matter of 3 years from now.
So do you think this will revolutionize space travel, at least maybe in the solar system?
I think so. We want to completely do a paradigm shift in the transportation arena in space.
So, Franklin, could your rocket take us to Proxima B, for instance?
Wow, that's a long way. This rocket as it is, no. The way I think of it is more like a precursor to the rocket that could take you to Proxima B.
Though Franklin is confident that future generations of his plasma rocket will be able to take us to an exoplanet, for now, his focus is on travel within the solar system. This rocket might reach Mars in 39 days, but it would still take 2,000 years to get to Proxima B. If we want to make it within Professor Hawking's timeframe, we need technology that's even faster.
Amazingly, there might be a way. And it's staring us right in the face.
The Sun, then the University of California.
In California, a team led by astrophysicist Philip Lubin is investigating an alternative propulsion method. They think they can get a spacecraft to Proxima B in just 20 years, powered only by light.
We can demonstrate that light carries momentum and energy very easily. If you take the torch here and shine it at these small veins, you can see that it'll begin to push the veins around.
And that's just the light that's doing that.
Yeah, the light itself transfers momentum and energy to the vein, and that propels it away.
Okay, but that isn't a very powerful light, and I wasn't going very fast, and that's also very small as well, so...
Yeah, it's really a scaling problem. Increase the power level, then suddenly we have a very effective tool for propelling spacecraft that are suitable for interstellar flight.
This might seem like pure science fiction, but for the last 7 years, light from the sun has powered the Japanese spacecraft Icaros. This is a very real technology that works. Philip's master plan is to build a massive bank of lasers measuring 10 kilometers across. His spacecraft will unfurl a lightweight sail. The laser light pushes on the sail, accelerating the craft to 1/5 the speed of light.
A campus building at the water's edge.
Philip and his team are so confident this technology will work, they've already started designing tiny unmanned space probes to send to Proxima B.
Nick!
Hello, how are you?
Hi. Nick Rupert is building a fleet of spacecraft the size of a SIM card. Each with its own laser sail, they will fly out to the planet ahead of a human mission.
Wow, it is small, isn't it? So this is a prototype spacecraft.
Yes, there's capacitors right here. There's maybe 10 or so of them.
Wow, they're tiny.
Yes, very tiny.
I'm having a go at assembling some of the electronics for myself.
I'm going to choose that one.
All you have to do is line up the capacitor.
I always thought I had a steady hand as well. Okay.
Okay. So now what you're going to do is you're going to take the hot air gun back here.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to hold it about an inch away from the capacitor you just placed.
Mm-hmm.
And just move it back and forth slightly. And then it will actually solder itself down. So it should actually seat itself.
Oh, yeah, wow, okay.
You see it?
Wow-wee.
Yeah, it pulls itself right into place and lines up.
Wow-wee, that's like magic.
Uh-huh.
That's definitely the neatest that I've ever soldered.
This is a fully functional spacecraft, armed with sensors, cameras, and even tiny rockets to help it maneuver.
Initially, what will happen is it will fly sort of edge-on, and once you get to Proxima B, it will then flip up, and its sensors will take all of their data, all of their information, whether that be a camera, temperature sensors, and then it will actually flip around and send that data back.
So effectively, they could do like a flyby type thing of Proxima B.
And the idea would be you would have hundreds of these at a time. you sort of make a mosaic of all these individual data points, and you use that to paint sort of a much bigger picture of what you're looking at.
Nick hopes to have these probes in operation within the next 30 years. It's incredible to think vessels like these, powered solely by light, may be the first to glimpse the surface of Proxima B, giving us incredible insight into what this planet is really like. But these are just tiny unmanned spacecraft. Does Philip think we could use the same light propulsion technology on a craft that's big enough to carry people?
What I hadn't quite appreciated before today was how far along that technology roadmap you were. But can you scale that up? Can you use the same technology to have humans to travel interstellar?
There are many hard problems in this project. It's not a simple project.
No.
It's not easy and it's not cheap. But there's no fundamental reason why we couldn't build extremely large systems which would be capable of propelling humans to intergalactic distances. It's going to be fundamental transformation in human exploration.
Building a laser propulsion system that's big enough to transport humans does present us with challenges we're yet to solve. But this is a proven technology, and if we can succeed in scaling it up, it could reduce the travelling time to Proxima B from 2,000 years to just 20, well within Professor Hawking's 100-year deadline.
I have no doubt that we will eventually find ways of crossing the immense distances of space in just a few years. One of our species' great strengths is embracing new ideas and evolving them into cutting-edge technologies. Just look at advances we've made in the fields of medicine, communications, and electronics. We built the first silicon chip only 60 years ago. Now it powers just about every aspect of our lives. Our ingenuity will get us to Proxima B.
We now know what planet we're heading for and have seen technologies which could propel a spacecraft on the journey to Proxima B. But the people on board will be tested in ways we can hardly imagine. Now we need to find out what sort of people could rise to this challenge.
Okay, you can cover is open, you can egress the airlock if you want.
All right. Ready, ready, rock and roll. Let's go, buddy.
The International Space Station orbits the planet every 90 minutes. Today, it is the only place you find humans living in space. The current generation of astronauts have never been asked to leave the proximity of Mother Earth. But they have a unique perspective on the hardships that would be endured on an interplanetary journey. One of them is my fellow countryman, Thomas Pesquet. And I have arranged a live conversation with him while he's circling the Earth.
Hello.
He enters the control room of the European Astronaut Center.
Thomas knows a thing or two about what it's like to be stuck in a tin can for long periods. He's been crewing the space station for the last 6 months. I want to know his perspective on the pressures an interplanetary journey would put on the human psyche.
Station, this is Houston. Are you ready for the event?
Station, yes, we're ready for the event.
30 seconds.
I can see that he's tidied up his room, which is another.
10 seconds.
European Space Agency, this is Mission Control Houston. Please call station for a voice check.
Station, this is Jules from ESA PAO here in Cologne. How do you hear me?
You're 5x5, how me?
Hello, Thomas. Very, very honored to be speaking with you.
No, pleasure for me too.
I begin by asking Thomas about the challenges of living on board a spaceship.
I like outdoor sports and activities. And of course, here in the ISS, the chances to go out are very few and in between, and far in between. But I'm missing the freedom to go, you know, wherever I want, whenever I want, because it's a confined space. But obviously, it's one of the challenges of the job, and we all accept it.
But how much worse would it be to undertake an interplanetary journey?
What big problems do you think we would have to overcome, maybe psychologically, to get to another planet?
I think we're going to completely lose sight of the Earth. We're going to be alone in empty space, surrounded by blackness. Thank God on the International Space Station, we're still connected. We have a way to call on the phone. We have a way to exchange emails, even though it's rather limited, but it's better than nothing. The longer, deeper space journey, it'll be more challenging. Time delay in the communications makes direct communication almost impossible. So we'll have to find the right people for this. We'll have to keep them busy, because when you have a lot to do, then you don't have time to think about it. You don't have time to think about the danger. You don't have time to think about the consequences. You don't have time to think too much, to second guess yourself sometimes. So we need to find a way to keep people busy all the time, and then the trip is going to be okay, I think.
Would you volunteer for such a journey? To Mars and even another planet?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I'd like to think of the astronaut corps as modern explorers. I think it's in our DNA as human beings, and especially as astronauts. So if one day we're asked to volunteer for such a trip, I'll raise my hand, but I know I won't be the only one, so they'll have to choose which way is more worthy of the trip.
It's absolutely incredible to be able to speak with you. Thank you so much for your time and for the work you're doing.
Welcome. It was a pleasure to have you on board the ISS.
Our interplanetary mission to Proxima B will require many astronauts like Thomas. For those chosen, it's going to be a huge emotional challenge. And I've been wondering, do I have what it takes to join them? I've decided to ask the experts.
If we want to understand who to select to found a colony on a new planet, where better to come than the place they've been selecting and training astronauts for decades?
So this is the US laboratory module. And this is our galley table, where our crew would gather for dinner every
here
night.
At NASA's Johnson Space Center, astronaut Mike Barrett is giving me a tour of the International Space Station mock-up, where he and the other astronauts train.
It's bilingual station. Everybody has to be proficient in English and Russian.
And Russian? Really?
Yep. So for us, it's hard enough to learn Russian. For the Russians, they have to learn English. But interestingly, if you're Japanese, you still have to learn Russian and English.
Mike has done two long-duration trips to the ISS and spent 212 days in space.
All right, let's take a look at the Orion.
Wow.
Okay. With a future NASA Mars mission on the cards, Mike has already put some thought into what will be needed in interplanetary astronauts.
We look at Mars now as the next destination, as something that's remote and difficult to do. But in the long run, Mars will be an inner waypoint. It'll be an inner outpost from which we will continue to branch out. And when you look at how people have moved across our planet from, say, Europe to the Western world, you first have the explorers, and they're the ones who see things for the first time and characterize what the environment is like, the risk, if you will. And if it looks like a good place to go, you're followed by the pioneers, the people who learn to live there. And typically, pioneering is also fairly austere, but you go there with a certain knowledge and a certain resolve that you're there to stay. The pioneers are then followed by the colonists, if you will. The colonists bring what I would call a snapshot of humanity, of civilization, to occupy that spot. And so we really acquire that destination and make it our own.
So someone sitting at home on the sofa now could be an astronaut in a few generations' time,
absolutely,
colonizing a planet.
Absolutely. I mean, we look forward to a continual expansion of civilization. So the cycle will repeat over and over as we keep pushing the boundaries. We will start again with the explorers and the pioneers, and the colonists will eventually follow.
So do I have what NASA are looking for in an interplanetary explorer? It's time to pop the question.
I had a look on your website, and the application form for if you want to be an astronaut was there. So I filled it out.
Uh-huh.
I wanted to take a look at it, because I'm an engineer.
Yeah.
And so I was sort of thinking, oh, well, you know, maybe...
Well, you've got to play to win, so let's see what you got here. All right, a very distinguished scientist in your field and an extremely impressive list of awards and honors. Okay. However, what we like to see also is something beyond the laboratory that shows that you can be comfortable in an uncomfortable place. Spaceflight is still a very austere, extreme environment, and we're not much into creature comforts. So we look for people who've had expeditionary experience. We definitely look for people who want to explore and have the commitment to leave your home planet and go make another planet your own.
A train emerges from a tunnel into a snowy landscape.
I want to see if I have that courage and commitment myself. So I've signed up for an extreme adventure down here on Earth.
Finse, Norway. The train pulls into a station in bright sunlight and Danielle gets off.
This is Finse in central Norway. For over 100 years, intrepid adventurers, including Scott, Amundsen and Shackleton, have used this desolate landscape as a training ground. Today, polar explorer Anne Daniels is here preparing for an expedition to the North Pole. Anne pushes herself to the limits to explore uncharted places. And I want to find out what that feels like. She's taking me into the extreme wilderness to give me a sense of what exploration is really like.
Okay. If it's not good for your mission, and it doesn't get you anywhere, you don't take it.
Just like the pioneers of the early polar expeditions, the humans who voyage to another planet will be venturing into the complete unknown.
Anne and Danielle set off across the empty, snow-covered wasteland, walking on skis and pulling their kit behind them on the end of a long cord. Anne's leading the way.
Do you get a bit sort of sick of white when you're out here?
No. If you look around, there's different shades of white. It's beautiful. But when you get back to civilization, that's when the colours just hit you and you kind of...
Whilst astronauts on the space station are able to look down on the Earth, our crew will have years of travel through continual blackness. They will be the first generation who will lose sight of the Earth forever.
Okay, just here.
They're setting up camp, a stove.
Gather round the flames.
Oh, that's better.
Oh, there we go.
This is the most remote place I've ever been in my life. And the temperature's now minus 18 degrees. It makes me wonder, what drives a pioneer to go to places where no one else has been?
Being here with you today, it's really pushed me to my limits. What drives you to do what you do?
Why wouldn't I do something so great and different?
Because you've got a family, and this is really dangerous, right? I mean, you might die. For any expedition you do, you could die, couldn't you?
I could. I became an expert at the ice. And I kind of think the children are a barometer to me, because I have to come back. If I was going to cross an area of thin ice, I would look and think, can I cross it? Can I face my kids if I try and cross this? And if it was, yeah, then I would. So I think they kind of keep me safe.
So our space explorers would probably need the same thing.
If you're helping the world you live in, which, let's be honest, that in space they really are understanding new things, then it also makes you keep going, because you know it's the bigger picture.
Anne's outlook really defines the spirit of the explorer. But it's given me pause for thought about my own attitudes.
Looking up at the starry night sky.
It's almost inconceivable to think that somewhere out there, one day humans will be living. I have a 2-year-old daughter. Could I leave her indefinitely? Could I leave her on a quest where I may never come back?
where all she'd be is a memory and a photograph on a logbook to me. No, I really don't think I could. So this journey is really telling me a lot about the type of person our space explorers have to be and the sacrifices I think they're going to have to make.
I might not be the right person to make that one-way trip to a new world. But for Professor Hawking, there's no doubt that as a species, humans have got what it takes.
We are the first species in history that has the potential to escape Earth. We are the only ones driven by curiosity. Transcending our apparent limits is what makes humans unique. I am living proof of that. I lost my voice, but can still speak using my voice synthesizer. Gravity pins us to the ground, but I have taken a ride on a zero-gravity flight.
In Professor Hawking's view, with our adventurous spirit and a little help from technology, humans are capable of almost anything. A journey to Proxima B is within our reach. So how many of these adventurous humans will ultimately make this extraordinary journey? Once our astronauts have arrived, they'll soon have to breed to create a new human population that can thrive for generations to come. The answer to how many we need to create that could be here at Washington Smithsonian Zoo. Here they study not human populations, but endangered species. These are golden lion tamarins. Just 40 years ago, they were on the brink of extinction. Population geneticist Dr. Brandy Smith was part of the team behind the golden lion tamarins' impressive comeback.
Yeah, that would be busy for a while too.
So why did they nearly become extinct, Brandy?
Well, you know, they live in the same places that humans like to live. And so their habitat just began to decrease and become fragmented, and the tamarins just couldn't keep up. So there were only about 200 left in the wild. I have another one. And they were on the edge of extinction. They were critically endangered. And when populations get that low, you become concerned because essentially they start to lose genetic variability. And if climate change came through or a disease, the populations could be wiped out because they don't adapt to changing conditions.
The tamarins had a close shave. Using a controlled breeding program, Brandy and her team rescued this population, and they are now off the endangered list.
Are you in a grape? It's a big grape.
But that's a stark reminder for our human colony. If there's not enough genetic variation amongst the group we send, our population could easily go extinct. So perhaps then, we should be hand-picking our best genetic specimens to represent the human species.
Could we choose the individuals genetically to make sure that we had all of the right things we needed once we got to the planet?
Well, the problem is you don't know which genes to select. So the ones that might confer an advantage here on Earth might be totally, totally different if we went to another planet. They might not be the best, and they could also be detrimental.
So as a population geneticist, what's your professional opinion on how we should address this challenge?
You need to collect a sample that's large enough to get a good representation. You don't want to select. You want it to be a random population.
This means that to succeed in colonizing a planet like Proxima B, we must take potentially thousands of astronauts. And all of them will need to spend decades traveling through the hostile environment of space. Protecting their bodies will be a huge challenge. We didn't evolve for the alien environment of space, and its effects could be lethal. Even just a few months on the International Space Station has extreme effects on the astronauts who go there. And I'm going to see them for myself. I've been granted exclusive access to a NASA medical test.
I'm very excited about this. NASA don't normally let cameras see astronauts at this stage of their mission.
But over there is Kate Rubins. She's recently come back from a 115-day mission on the ISS.
Astronaut Mike Barrett is also a doctor and a leading expert in space medicine.
The human body changes almost globally when you put it in weightlessness. From the standpoint of fitness, we do lose bone and muscle because we don't have that normal daily challenge of gravity. But we also lose blood volume. So that makes you really good for weightlessness. As it turns out, it's very adaptive, if you will. But when you want to come back to Earth, it becomes maladaptive.
Visitors to the ISS do intense exercise regimes to build up muscle, but it isn't enough to combat the lack of gravity.
Standing by for touchdown.
By the time they return to Earth, astronauts are fragile and at risk of injury.
Flashing that familiar smile, Kate Rubins now out of the Soyuz spacecraft.
Kate, welcome back. You're looking good.
Hey!
Landing on a planet in this state, people would struggle to build anything, let alone a new civilization. And muscle wastage isn't the only problem. The lack of gravity also disrupts our sense of balance. The day they return to Earth, some astronauts have the coordination of a toddler.
I'll put one here.
One of those.
Even though she spent just 115 days in space, 5 months after her landing, Kate is still recovering.
Setting up a course for an astronaut.
It's all been carefully measured out, right?
All right.
Whenever you're ready and you go, I'm going to hit the start button.
Kate runs around a square of bollards.
So this actually gives us a better reflection of what a person is capable of in the post-flight period.
Sprint, 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 sprint. There we go.
It's muscular power, it's speed, agility, it's balance.
Does it feel weird? Is it when you're doing it, you're like, man, this should be really, really easy.
Like, try doing it on the deck of a moving ship. That's about what it feels like when we're landed.
If you've landed after 6 or 7 months of deep space cruise, you don't necessarily want to get out there and do an agility test or a maximum strength test right away. You may need a lander large enough to accommodate the entire crew in for a few days before you gain a little bit of strength and sea legs, if you will, land legs, so that you could walk to a habitat.
Yeah. Were there everyday things that you found really difficult to do when you came to it, back to it?
Yeah, I noticed a couple weeks afterwards I was grocery shopping and I went to go reach for something on a high shelf and I kind of had a moment, had to stop and get myself together a little bit. And it's those really rapid head movements. Anything where you're kind of changing the axis quickly will kick that issue off again, even if you're feeling fine just walking around.
What was the strangest thing for you when you got back in terms of, wow, I didn't realize that I couldn't do that?
I'd never really felt gravity before. I'd never understood it as an actual force. And you're incredibly aware the first few weeks after you land that gravity is very heavy. So something like picking up an iPhone, you know, it'll feel like it's 5 or 10 pounds and you actually feel it falling towards the earth when you try to put it down. Sitting there reading a book, trying to hold my hands up while I'm reading the book, I could feel gravity pulling my hands down and pulling the book down. And you adapt to that in everyday life. Your brain compensates for it. You never think about it. But you're definitely very, very aware of the very strong force that gravity affects upon us right after you land. So,
good job.
Thanks. I want to high-five an astronaut. All right.
Are you ready for another go?
All right.
All right.
If colonists are going to arrive at Proxima B in a fit state, we need to stop these effects from happening.
Get around the cone. Go!
He walks up to the German Aerospace Center, Cologne, a white, box-like, ultra-modern building. Inside, he makes his way down a flight of concrete steps.
The problems with balance and muscle loss which Kate experienced are caused by the lack of gravity in space. And the longer you spend without gravity, the worse the effects. Exercise alone will not guarantee they will arrive in good health. Maybe the answer is to simulate our own gravity in space. Researchers in Germany are trying to protect astronauts from muscle wastage by generating artificial gravity.
So should I just lie down
just
here?
Lay down. Right, perfect.
Okay.
This is a human centrifuge. When it spins, it exerts a force on my body, making me feel like I'm standing up and experiencing gravity.
Do it right, huh? I don't want to fly away.
So first you do a comp check, experiment operator.
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me back?
Yeah. Wonderful. Mm-hmm.
This is tight now.
Okay, so just relax, enjoy the ride.
Thank you.
See you later.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye. Locking door.
To the stars.
Starting in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Starting centrifuge. Centrifuge started.
So, the spinning has started. Now, the effect of the centrifuge is that things are pulled from the center outward. I can feel my muscles and my bones and my legs being pushed against the footrest. So it kind of feels a bit like gravity. And I can feel my heart beating faster, trying to pump my blood back up. And it's quite a weird feeling.
This is exercising not only my heart, but also the bones and muscles in my lower body. The same areas that weigh so dramatically during spaceflight.
Whoa! Now I really feel lightheaded. It truly does feel as if I'm standing almost upright and the walls are spinning around me, but I'm not moving. I don't feel myself moving. I feel heavy.
So your actual heart rate is 110. Stopping centrifuge.
Oh, now my body is readapting to normal gravity. And that's not a nice feeling at all. It's like I'm falling backwards. It's a bit like when you're drunk. Et voilà.
Centrifuge safe.
These guys think that if astronauts performed exercises while spinning in a centrifuge for just 20 minutes every day, their bodies wouldn't waste away in space at all.
I really feel like you're standing. Yeah. It's crazy. Yeah.
However, this machine is currently only designed for use on the ground to research the effects of artificial gravity on the human body. Installing enough of these centrifuges on a spacecraft to keep an entire crew healthy would mean an enormous amount of extra weight. But Professor Hawking thinks there might be a better way to use the same principle.
There is a simple solution. Make the entire spaceship a centrifuge. A spaceship with the diameter of the London Eye would only need to rotate about 4 times faster than currently to counter the physical effects of space. Building rotating spacecraft is an easy way to overcome the human body's struggles with zero gravity.
While there is impressive work being done to overcome the challenges posed by the lack of gravity in space, that isn't the only problem with sending humans to Proxima B. Deep space is full of radiation.
Svalbard, Norway.
And radiation is deadly to humans. It can infiltrate cells and damage DNA. Here on Earth, humans are protected because our planet generates a defensive shield. But head to the poles, and you can catch glimpses of its otherwise invisible power.
He's gazing at shimmering green lights in the night sky.
This is the first time I see the Northern Lights in my life. I've been wanting to see them for years, since I was a kid, I think. And they're huge! They're everywhere! The whole sky is lit!
they are created by our own star, the Sun, which fires a constant stream of particles towards the Earth. Sometimes, bursts of these particles are so powerful that they reach our planet's atmosphere, producing these waves of color. This light show only happens in the skies above our polar regions because of the shape of our planet's magnetic shield. Far away under our feet, around the Earth's solid core, there is liquid iron turning around, creating a magnetic field that protects our whole planet, except at the poles, north and south, where solar particles can sneak in. We believe most of the stars in the universe emit such radiation. There is radiation everywhere. And if we weren't protected by our own planet's magnetic field, we wouldn't be able to survive here on Earth. This shield extends for tens of thousands of miles into space. But a crew would be far beyond this protection on a trip to Proxima B. This is another challenge that researchers will have to overcome.
Daytime. Our Hans Zoo, Netherlands. A large brown bear.
Radiation is one of the biggest problems facing deep space exploration. So far, scientists are yet to find material which is light and strong enough to block these radiations, or a feasible way of generating a magnetic field that could protect an entire ship. But nature might offer a way around this problem. Amazingly, the key to surviving radiation exposure on a journey deep into space might lurk in this enclosure.
Hello, Rob.
Dr. Robert Henning is a pharmacologist who has worked closely with the European Space Agency.
There's a bear in that den, but it's too dark here to see it. But with the thermal camera, you can actually pick up its body heat. You can see a tiny white piece of the bear. It's just around.
That's the heat. That's the heat coming out of the bear.
That's the heat coming out of the bear.
Rob is interested in a bit of bear behavior, which no other large mammal exhibits: hibernation.
Hibernation is not sleeping. Hibernation is slowing of metabolism.
So it's a bit like being alive, but in extreme slow motion, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
During hibernation, animals need virtually no food. If we could find a way of putting our crew into a similar state of hibernation on their journey to Proxima B, it would greatly reduce the amount of supplies they'd need to take.
I can see why hibernation can be a very good thing for space traveling. Mm-hmm. But we do have a big problem in space, that there is a lot of radiation, and that could harm our DNA, so we need to find an answer to that.
Well, the interesting thing is that hibernators are also protected from radiation.
So you're telling me that bears hibernating in space would not be harmed by radiation?
Yes.
That's crazy, you know that.
Yeah.
Even more incredibly, Rob thinks he's found the key chemical that controls this process. And it could be used to put humans into hibernation and protect their DNA from radiation damage. He discovered this chemical in hibernating hamsters.
This is a hamster cell which has been in the fridge for 3 days.
Okay.
And we left it accidentally there. It was not on purpose. We just forgot about it. And after 3 days, we came back. They looked pretty okay. And then we unscrewed the top. And then there came the big surprise.
Christoph sniffs the bottle.
Oh, that's the rotten egg.
That's hydrogen sulfide, yeah. Right? Oh. Yeah.
It smells bad.
It smells bad. Yeah.
So that means that the cell themselves produce...
They produce the hydrogen sulfide. Now, we know that hydrogen sulfide can sort of replace oxygen. It's not as efficient as oxygen, but it's probably efficient enough to keep you alive. And so we think this is an important part of hibernation.
Using a chemical very similar to hydrogen sulfide, Rob can put human cells into a state of hibernation. Astonishingly, when he exposes these cells to lethal levels of radiation, their DNA remains undamaged.
So this compound protects against radiation damage. The long jump would be, maybe we should feed the astronauts this compound. But if we put a human into hibernation, I don't have any idea right now how to wake them up and when to wake them up.
So knowing this, would you try to hibernate, to be put in hibernation?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've thought about it a long, long time, and I just think that if I were the first, I would do it. I mean, to me, yeah, it sounds like a dream come true. Then,
if Rob can use this chemical to create a serum for humans, then our astronauts could hibernate throughout the long journey to Proxima B. That would protect them from radiation and would mean they'd need far fewer supplies. Using new propulsion technologies and simulating gravity, they could be arriving at our new planet in a healthy state after 20 years. But to fulfill Professor Hawking's vision, they must then face the epic task of building a new civilization when they get there.
Colonizing the planet Proxima B will challenge our species like nothing before. Although we think it has similarities to Earth, it is very unlikely to be exactly the same as our current home. The crew may have to adapt to life in a very alien world.
Sunlight over the desert landscape.
From what we can determine about Proxima B, our pioneers may need to brace themselves for a very strange climate. Although it sits in the Goldilocks zone, unlike Earth, not all of Proxima B is fit for human habitation. In fact, the habitable zone on its surface may not extend very far.
Water here on Earth is liquid because of our planet's relationship with its star. Our star is the Sun. As the Earth orbits the Sun, it rotates.
Most parts of the planet are warmed by the Sun to just the right temperature for water to exist as a liquid. But we think Proxima B is different. Its own rotation is likely to be synchronized with its orbit. The same side of the planet always faces its star, making it so hot any water here would turn to gas. The opposite side never receives heat from the star. Any water here would solidify into a thick ice cap. Liquid water could only exist in a narrow strip between these two extremes. This is the only place that could support life and support us.
Our colonists will need to use this precious area of land wisely. They must quickly master their surroundings and create a sustainable habitat. The limited supplies on their spacecraft will quickly run out, so their most pressing concern will be to start producing food in this alien environment. Luckily, there may already be a solution. On the Arctic island of Svalbard, people have been planning for the kind of event that might one day force us to leave this planet.
Deep inside this mountain is one of the greatest treasures ever gathered by mankind, and one that may well prove crucial to colonizing other worlds, faraway planets like Proxima B.
Entering a tunnel.
We're going through a tunnel that will take us about 130 meters inside of a solid stone mountain. Of course, that does two things. One is it removes us from whatever accidents or bad things can happen on the outside, but it's also very cold here. So we have a natural freezer. A woman yesterday said to me, she said, you know, this is the most important room on Earth. And I hadn't really thought of it that way, but that's what it is.
Here's the room with the most agricultural biodiversity on Earth.
Think of it as a library of life. The Russian ones, Sweden, Mexico.
For the last 30 years, Carrie Fowler has gathered together seeds of the most important food crops from virtually every country on our planet. He keeps them frozen here in the global seed vault. The idea behind it is simple yet extraordinary. If crops fail because of climate change, war, or a disaster, these are the backups that will reseed the planet.
This is a big corn maize collection here. We have probably more than 30,000 different varieties of that. And here's the Canadian collection. Here's a collection from Taiwan. And here's some boxes, very colorful, very strong, from North Korea. Each one of these varieties has co-evolved with human beings. You can see our human culture embodied in these different varieties because people have selected for different characteristics the things that they wanted and needed.
There is something kind of sad in what you're doing, but also quite, I don't know, reassuring.
You know, think of this as just an insurance policy for agriculture, and it's like any insurance policy. You never want to really use it.
The sheer variety in this seed vault makes it the ideal place to find crops that may grow on Proxima B.
Here's rice. Not the Asian kind of rice, but African rice that grows in dry land conditions.
So that might be something I would like to take on a journey in outer space.
I wouldn't mind having
because
some
rice,
of that,
when you think of it, yeah. you need a lot of water.
Yes.
To grow it, and that's not the case for this one.
So you want something from this box. Here's a big bean collection that's come from Costa Rica. That's something your astronaut will want to take. You'd actually like to take a little bit of everything, frankly.
Yeah.
This was built to protect the future of humanity on Earth. And the thing is, it may well protect the future of humanity in outer space as well. There are about 1 million different strains of crops inside these vaults, all of them having different properties, allowing them to grow in wildly different conditions here on Earth. Taking a broad range of seeds with us on a space journey may be our chance to finding the one crop that will thrive on another world, allowing our species to colonize a new planet. On arrival on Proxima B, the colonists will be able to select the seeds best suited to the alien conditions and create farms that will feed generations to come. But for our settlers and their crops, to survive on another planet, there's something else they'll need. An atmosphere. Here on Earth, our atmosphere acts as a protective blanket. It insulates the planet, keeping it at a constant habitable temperature. It shields us from harmful radiation and cosmic rays. It creates atmospheric pressure that stops our bodily fluids from simply evaporating away. And crucially, it provides the oxygen we breathe. Currently, we don't know the composition of Proxima B's atmosphere, or indeed whether it has one at all. So if it doesn't have the oxygen-rich atmosphere we need, could we create one ourselves? We might find a solution by looking back at the history of our own planet. Oxygen in Earth's atmosphere wasn't present when the planet formed. It was created later, by life itself. Microbiologist Dr. Maria Farias works in the salt flats and lagoons of the Atacama Desert, studying these tiny planet-transforming creatures.
Ah, bubbles.
Bubbles, full of bubbles. Pure oxygen. You can see?
Wow.
These microbes are known as extremophiles. They thrive here in these hostile conditions.
Well, if that doesn't look like an alien life form, I don't know what it is.
Those are microbial mats.
Wow.
This is all bacteria.
This is only bacteria?
This is a bacterial community.
Yes.
You see all the layers, many layers, different colors.
I see.
On the top, you have orange. They are very resistant to UV radiation. Then you see green, okay?
Yeah.
These green are cyanobacteria.
All right.
They do photosynthesis and they produce oxygen.
It sounds extremely precious when you say it like that.
These bacteria are known to have appeared on Earth over 3 billion years ago. Back then, the Earth was very hostile, with high UV radiation, volcanic activity, and a toxic atmosphere with barely any oxygen.
So these things basically have changed the shape of the Earth.
Yes, in extreme conditions, these microorganisms started to produce oxygen and to liberate it, and they changed the planet. They produced the ozone layer, and they made this blue planet and prepared the planet for another kind of life that depends on oxygen.
If Proxima B lacks life of its own, it could lack the oxygen in its atmosphere to make it breathable. So, should colonists take along some extremophile cyanobacteria?
You think these things could change the atmosphere of another planet?
Yes, they did it in this planet. They could do it again.
Making a hostile planet habitable like this is a process scientists call terraforming. And their ability to survive in extreme conditions makes these bacteria the perfect tools.
To grow, they will use the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and produce oxygen. Once there is enough oxygen, we send in plants and trees, and these will raise the oxygen level even faster. And then we wait until eventually the atmosphere becomes suitable for us, human, to breathe and live in.
But we could be waiting a long time. It's estimated that to generate the oxygen we'd need to survive on an inhospitable planet, we'll have to terraform for hundreds of thousands of years. If Professor Hawking is right, and we should be colonizing another world within the next 100 years, this is far too slow. So in the meantime, our pioneers will need to find another way to live and farm on a planet without an atmosphere. Fortunately for our colonists, agricultural engineers are already working on a solution.
Tucson, Arizona.
Campus Agricultural Center. What's it doing in here? It's very busy. There's a lot of sheep around. Really not what I was expecting.
She gets out of the car. Someone leading a cow passes by the other way.
Hello!
Hi!
Here at the University of Arizona in Tucson, I'm meeting Professor of Space Agriculture, Jean Giacomelli.
Jean!
Howdy!
Hi! Tanya!
Welcome to the Wild West! Isn't this great?
Very wild! It's great!
Jean's working on a man-made structure that we could carry with us to allow us to live on a planet with no atmosphere.
Okay, Jean, so we arrive on a planet with no atmosphere. How are you going to keep me alive?
Well, first we begin with a structure that could put something in between us inside and that harsh environment outside. The structure has to be lightweight and it has to be collapsible. Much like this, it would be collapsed during transport and then expanded outward once it got to the planet.
Ah, I see it now. So what you have in your laboratory here is really just a giant version of this.
Exactly. Well, then you have to put life support inside.
Right.
Oxygen and fresh water has to be there to keep the people alive.
But how do you provide life support inside a tube when you're on an alien planet?
And the answer is plants.
Wow.
Jean's created a space survival pod that's filled with plants. This would allow a single human to live and breathe on a planet that had no natural atmosphere.
As the plants photosynthesize, they will remove the carbon dioxide and provide all of the oxygen, all of the fresh water, and half of the daily calories needed to sustain one person.
These lights are so bright.
These are LED lights, red and blue, and it's what the plant dictates to us that they need to grow.
Jean's leaving me in charge of looking after the plants to let me experience what living in one of these pods on an alien planet might be like. I have to say, so far, living in such a small space without the ability to roam and explore isn't much fun.
I'm getting bored now. I know what I'll do. I'll try some music. See if you like meatloaf. You can't not like this. Sweet potatoes. Feel a little bit like that dude on the Martian. Like I am completely alone, with no one to talk to apart from the plants, and they're not great at conversation, and no one to sing to.
She dances around, playing air guitar.
Really bored. Really bored.
Jean's pods are small and light enough to be set up quickly. But if my experience is anything to go by, claustrophobia would drive our colonists insane. In the long run, we need to think bigger.
Biosphere 2, Oracle, Arizona, a cluster of futuristic domed greenhouse-like structures.
This is Biosphere 2. Earth's biosphere is the invisible bubble of atmosphere, water, and life that blankets our planet. Here, they've replicated it on a smaller scale, using some incredible feats of engineering.
I find it incredible that just there is the Arizona desert. Yet inside these glass domes, we can recreate almost any environment on Earth.
There's a rainforest, an ocean, and a desert. All created and maintained using man-made structures. This was originally built as the ultimate experiment into whether humans could sustainably live in the hostile environment of space. In 1991, 8 people lived inside this completely sealed dome for 2 years. It's true they did go a bit stir crazy in the end, but it's a lot more habitable than those small survival pods. In the miles of tunnels that sit underground beneath the greenhouses, Biosphere's director, Dr. Joaquin Ruiz, shows me some of the technology required to keep Biosphere 2 running.
So the infrastructure we see here, just to replicate an Earth-like system, is amazing. I mean, the engineering that we can see just around us is huge, isn't it?
It is indeed. And all these things that you see here to your right is all the air cooling and heating that's required to keep the place alive. And that's the stainless steel that is underneath the whole biosphere so that there's no interactions between the soil and the biosphere itself. So the thing was sealed from the top and it was sealed from the bottom, and this is what it takes to cool the whole thing. The original experiment had two reasons for it being. One of them was trying to understand in detail how various biomes of the Earth operate. So there's an ocean and a rainforest. And the other one was, what would it take to create a structure that you would build in another planet and you could basically live in it in a sustainable way?
But there's no way we could actually take all of this, though, is there?
Because if you're going to be in another planet, you're going to have to deal with its atmosphere. You're going to have to deal with your growing plants. So yeah, something like this, or at least the concepts that are in here with different materials that aren't as heavy and so on, you would have to take.
I'd never thought about the Earth systems from an engineer's perspective before. It's just incredible, the amount of infrastructure required to mimic, even on a small scale, what our planet does for us naturally.
In one of the underground engineering rooms,
it really does just bring home the engineering challenge required to support even just a handful of humans living in an alien environment.
It would take the settlers decades to build something on this scale. And we currently have no way of transporting the heavy construction materials on a spacecraft. But might there be a way to have everything ready and waiting for us when we arrive? Could it be done by robots we send in advance?
Danielle's behind the wheel.
Robotics is something close to my heart. I'm fascinated by the revolution in capabilities. But are we really ready to send them to a distant planet like Proxima B? To start building a new civilization? Well, I guess it's time to ask the experts.
Cape Canaveral.
At NASA's Kennedy Space Center, engineer Rob Muller is developing an army of autonomous robots that could set up an entire colony on Proxima B before any humans arrive. Starting with machines that can locate the raw materials we'd need to build habitations and infrastructure, without having to transport them from Earth.
These are incredible little things, aren't they?
These are what we call the swarmies, which is a small robot designed to mimic the behavior of ants. And they're very small, and we'll have hundreds of these on the surface looking for resources.
Inspired by ants, these robots will have sensors that can scan the planet's surface for resources, such as water, metals, and fuel. When one swarmie detects something, it sends a signal to the others to direct them to the same spot.
In nature, the ants go around and they look for resources in a kind of a random walk, and they leave a pheromone trail behind. What we will do is track the same kind of pheromone trail in software, and then once the swarmies, which are mimicking the ants, find the resources, one of the robots will raise its hand and say, "I found a resource," and all the other robots will converge by following the digital trail, the breadcrumb trail that we left in the software.
That's incredible. So we're using strategies that you would find in nature, like in ants, to actually create the new generation of robots.
Absolutely. We're using just thousands of years of evolution to our advantage.
The swarmies could find everything we need to build a new colony within the surface of the planet itself.
The material that you find on a planetary surface is called regolith. And regolith is crushed rock. It's been crushed by billions of years of impacts on these planetary surfaces. And so as a result, the crushed rock is extremely fine and dusty.
If you just drive one stick, it moves one side. The other stick moves the other side. So it's kind of like a tank steer. So to drive forward, both sticks at the same time.
Once the swarmies have located useful resources in this regolith, Rob and his team have developed a mining robot to dig up the material.
So why are you scooping the surface? What are you hoping to find with that surface regolith?
On the moon, 42% of the regolith by mass is oxygen. So if you needed breathing air, you would simply scoop up the regolith, process it, and you're good to go.
Wow.
Yes, on Mars, you have hydrated minerals, and you can extract the water from the hydrated minerals. Then you would have water for drinking, growing plants, and you can also electrolyze the water, get hydrogen and oxygen, which is rocket propellant. And then the waste material, even that's useful. You use that for construction.
Rob's fully automated production line transforms the planetary dust into a mind-blowing variety of building materials.
We can make many things. For example, this is some rope, stronger than fiberglass. This material here is a mixture of a polymer and a regolith. So this is concrete for space.
Wow.
This is rebar, used already today. Instead of steel rebar, it doesn't corrode, it's very strong, and it's very cheap. This is a paver that's in the shape of a puzzle piece. And this was done simply by taking the regolith, putting it in a mold, and then you bake it in an oven. And we assemble these with robots, and then we have a landing pad in space for landers to land on. Now, can you imagine launching this into space? I can barely pick this up. It makes a lot more sense to use the local materials and make it there.
So you literally could do everything. I mean, literally everything we need to build a new civilization on
everything is there. We just have to have imagination and ingenuity. We have to invent new technologies so that as a civilization we can move into outer space to have a healthy future with abundance.
Rob's vision shows us that sending robots to build a colony on Proxima B is possible. And it's the final piece in our technological jigsaw. We set out on this journey to explore Stephen Hawking's challenge. Can we leave our planet and set up a new home for humanity within 100 years?
It sounded impossible, but the scientists we've met are bringing this goal closer to reality than we'd ever imagined. We are making massive leaps in rocket technology. We're understanding how to protect our bodies in space.
Whoa.
And even how to build a new civilization millions of miles from Earth.
But do we believe these scientists will succeed within our time frame? Well, many of these projects may be in their fledgling stages. But just think about the progress we've made in the last 100 years. Our modern world of smartphones, satellites, air travel, and the internet would have sounded like science fiction a century ago.
History tells us that technology advances exponentially and unpredictably if we have the drive to succeed.
You have all of these people who are working together for this common goal of finding the next Earth.
It's passion. All these people are driven by passion, and I love that.
So just maybe within the next century, humans could be making a new home on a distant planet.
Our species' natural curiosity is what will drive us to distant planets. But advances also come with a responsibility. Many of the reasons I think humans need to leave the Earth are down to the way we have used technology. Pollution, climate change, uneven overpopulation, spring to mind. We must learn from mistakes we have made here on Earth. In the next 100 years, we will embark on our greatest ever adventure. Our destiny is in the stars. Space, here we come.
To find out more about new worlds and life beyond Earth, go to bbc.co.uk/New Earth and follow the links to the Open University.